Welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where we learn history through popular culture. Today's episode is about the 2004 Morgan Spurlock documentary, Super Size Me. As a topical documentary, the film is itself both a reflection of American foodways of the era and the film industry at the time. A fellow social studies teacher, Jamie, who teaches in New Mexico, helped me start this conversation back in December. You and your students can add to the dialogue by going to everything-history.com/classroom and searching for this and many other open source entries there.
Mexico, and that's what I love about this place so far is just it's a meeting, it's a congress really of all the social studies teachers across the country, and as we share what we do in our classrooms, and we see a lot of parallels. I think have you recognized that from meeting people all over the country here?
Oh yeah, I think that this is probably one of my favorite convenings because you see that people from everywhere are working and trying to do the same things that you're trying to do. Mm. And so it just builds this beautiful community.
And we're all here for the same reason. That's because we care about kids.
Absolutely.
And want to make sure that, and of course we're biased because we're social studies people, but I really do think that our discipline is the hub.
Oh, yes.
You know, because unlike all the other ones, we are expected to teach, and we gladly do it, not just history, but economics, psychology, sociology, anthropology, you name it,
law,
within
everything.
Law,
yes.
and not just as individual classes necessarily, but within one particular class,
yes,
we incorporate all those things. So
absolutely.
It's not like the hard sciences where we're like, well, these two elements combined equals something else. It's like we are able to incorporate so much, and so you and I share an interest in pop culture and recognize that it has its place in the classroom, that it's not just a, I don't know if you remember this when you were in school, but that feeling when the teacher rolled in the TV.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, yes.
It's movie day.
Nowadays, the kids that we teach don't have that experience because most classes have some kind of giant screen already fixed to the wall. So
right.
It's not like today could be a PowerPoint, but it could also be a video, or if my teacher is nimble with these things, it could be both, it could be do it all. So what you chose to talk about today is, it's a documentary, but it comes from an era where it seemed like documentaries were becoming like commercial movies as well, like they were promoted along the same lines, and I'm thinking of like those I forget the guy's name. He made like Bowling for Columbine.
Oh, Michael Moore.
Michael Moore.
Yeah.
Notice how quickly his name has kind of left us because he's not as relevant anymore.
Right.
But 20 years ago, he was everywhere, and they were promoting his documentaries like feature films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two thumbs up from Siskel and Ebert. Like, they don't tend to do that. Like, I don't remember Ken Burns' Civil War being put out like that. So you chose Super Size Me.
I did.
From 2004, and the question that I brought up to go along with is, why did they make it? It's a pretty big undertaking because, well, if you don't mind just kind of summarizing what Super Size Me is all about, what did the gentleman do to make the documentary?
Yeah, if I'm recalling correctly, what Super Size Me is about is basically all of our fast food chains like McDonald's were upgrading their portion sizes for what they were putting out. So instead of just getting a cheeseburger and a regular fry, they would always ask, would you like to supersize that?
Yeah.
And so then you would get the extra, extra large super...
Like a bucket of soda.
Yes, a bucket of soda and a giant pail of fries, and then you would also get your burger. And so basically what the creator of the film did was he said, what happens if you do that with every meal you eat for about 30 days? And if I eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and any time they ask the question, would you like to supersize that? The answer is yes. What will that do to my body? And so that's what we followed, was that journey.
Yeah, that seems to be, I wonder where he came up with that idea, And I'll have to go back and double check what the gentleman's name is, because I think he did other documentaries before and after that. But this was, it seems to be relevant to the time period of that sort of almost like performance art type things in media, in television, and like the mockumentary was kind of big, or the almost like candid camera type guerrilla style. Like, I'm thinking of like Borat. You know, Borat, that movie came out around that time.
Right.
There was the Tom Green show in the late 90s, early 2000s, where he would just, renegade, run around with a camera and put microphones in people's faces and act like an oaf and get people to act weird. And it seemed like he could have done the same documentary without actually eating the food. It could have been like a frontline PBS thing where, like, McDonald's is serving, and just kind of showing it from the outside.
Right.
And
he could have talked to doctors, right? And he could have just been like, oh, give me why this is so bad. But instead, he lived it. And that's what made it so unique.
And there also is, so in that time period, and it's so funny talking about the 2000s as a time period, but it is. Yeah, especially how rapidly things have transformed and evolved since then, that it is almost like its era, isolated to itself. It was a big time for DVDs. So not only was this in the theaters, I think, but it was a pretty quick turnaround time to get it onto DVD. And because DVD boxes all kind of looked the same, it was easy, I think, for anybody who wanted to talk against it to have, like a protest piece almost. And I think I remember somebody did just that. They said, all right, well, this guy cut some corners. He left some things out. He, in the editing process of this documentary, he didn't mention these other things. I went and did the same experiment, and I actually lost weight. Not me. I didn't do it.
Right, but the person.
I did eat a lot of McDonald's back then, but it wasn't, out of any kind of experiment. It was just because I was hungry. And I show the results ever since then. But it's like they were just, it was a way to counter each other. And it seemed that the Blockbusters were still around, and the Walmarts that had just a sea of DVDs, the cover art, they could easily, just that alone could be like countering each other, balancing each other out in some way. Do you think that anything along those lines, like just the cover of the guy stuffing the fries in his face, is consistent? Like, can we get anything out of that for the time period of the early 2000s of just like this overload? I guess what I'm saying is, like, if we lined up other forms of media at the same time, you turn on the news networks, and I think Fox News does it definitely, CNN even, but like there's the giant scream. I remember watching, around 2004, that's, Iraq, before that Afghanistan, and I remember like an eagle would fly by the screen and, it's like, so like both sides, like you had, the more conservative leaning or, the Bush era and the, Bush supporters, large, louder than light, big
symbology,
a lot
Texas.
Of symbology. Like big belt buckles and, and then you even had a lot of noise coming from the other side too. Like all that, like Green Day makes an entire album, American Idiot, and that's on the radio. It's on, the video is right there in your face. There's, they make a whole rock opera about the whole, so like, it's a very busy time for media in that era where everybody's trying to get their ideas in there. And it doesn't just stop with the content. It's the cover art as well. It's like, we need to get your attention. So what better than to have this guy
stuffing his face with French fries.
Right. So do you think this documentary would have been around 10 years earlier or 10 years later?
No.
Would have had the same audience?
No, I don't think it would have. And I guess I kind of to your point of that question, like everything was bigger and better. And that's kind of always the direction we were kind of heading at that time. Like the 90s were a pretty decent time to be around in. And so maybe it was just like, well, it's great, but we can always improve and be better and bigger and all those things. And so I think time and place definitely has a lot to do with why it was successful then, and also why we haven't seen a lot from him since.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would think that that time period says a lot about who we were then.
Right. So I feel like a little bit earlier in the 90s, that's when the supersized thing even showed up on menus.
Right, yeah.
And it was kind of a big deal.
Right.
And it actually was a big deal in the story. Yeah, it was a good deal, too.
Well, yeah, and everything was a deal.
Yeah,
right.
And it was like a sign of a really good economy that, mm-hmm. you know, these yes. places were. And the audience of fast food has traditionally been usually lower income
Absolutely.
Families.
Yeah.
You know, and McDonald's was able to do something, and all these restaurants were able to do things that, welfare programs could only hope to do, and that's to feed families for under $10.
Right.
You know, not healthy food,
right.
but it's still
feeding
them.
No, you could
them.
Get the whole thing for $5.
Right. Back then.
Yeah.
Now it's like 50, but, you know, it's
exactly.
like everything's changed so much. But the, so in the 90s, that's one thing. You get to 2000s. I want to think that there was almost like a collective disappointment from a lot of us that once we hit 2000, it wasn't this utopia that we were hoping for. We were almost promised, like, hey, when the number 2 is at the front of our date,
right,
followed by nice even 3, you know, everything for most of the 20th century was like, if you wanted to make it sound futuristic and forward, think you just use the
right.
word 2000, like, oh,
right.
this is good. Arcade 2000,
yeah.
you know. But when we get there, and then a little bit after, we're like, oh, you know, we still have this baggage from, like...
Oh, and in a lot of ways, the baggage has changed, and the things that you thought were definite in the 2000s, mm-hmm. or even the 90s going into the 2000s, the things you thought we were just going to improve on forever, that all was a facade, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not true, and I think it's made a lot of us kind of question the reality that we lived in then and now.
Yeah. I think a lot of us pictured, including probably the maker of that documentary, that once we hit 2000, everybody would be like, you know, only green food for me. Like, I will, you know, everything's going to be nutritious, and, you know, we're going to have robots serving us, you know, our exact, you know, portions that we
right.
need. And But
well,
instead, we have...
There was also a trust. Like, there was a massive trust, I think, that people had in the things that were being provided to them. So, like, when you think of fast food, nobody was really questioning, how is this going to impact my health? Like, mm-hmm. that was never a question that I had.
Right. Because we were like, yeah, how bad can it be?
Right, yeah. exactly. Because if they're putting it out, somebody's regulating this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just get it and not even think about it again.
It was almost a repeat of the century before, where it took really the Pure Food and Drug Act
right.
to highlight, and it was a muckraker, kind of
right.
like
absolutely.
This guy's a muckraker,
yes.
you know, that, you know, said, well, it's actually dangerous to eat this stuff,
right.
you know, back then, because you don't know what's in it.
Absolutely.
And then we get the Food and Drug Act, which, you know, of course, I'm speaking to a social studies teacher, I don't need to explain any of this stuff, but for the listeners, you know, that's where it all originated from. So almost exactly 100 years later, it's not about necessarily the physical food itself and whether or not there's stuff in there that you don't want to eat. It's more about the nutritional value
yes.
or lack thereof, the calorie count. And I think it was around that time, maybe even as a result of movies like this, documentaries like this, where they started to add the calories onto the menu to show you what you were doing.
It's that, and he actually changed the food industry. So I like the parallel to the muckrakers, because that's what he ended up
yeah.
doing.
Because all the documentarians,
of this,
yeah.
Right. Because of this, we don't see supersized food anymore. Like, you can get a small, medium, and large, mm-hmm. but you can't go beyond that size
yeah.
anymore, and it was because of this documentary.
Like, we'll get the bag out bag. You just ordered the bag size,
right.
you know, fries, and here
exactly.
you go. Exactly. I think the last thing I just want to touch on, cause whenever I think of early 2000s, and this the cover of this movie and the poster that went along with it definitely speaks to it, it's always pure white backgrounds. Because I think that was the vision for a long time. It was, you know, like, if you've ever been to an H&M, I think that's how, like, H&M now and has always been, I think is how most people envisioned the early 2000s to be. Even in that era of, like, yes, this is nice and clean and pure
yes.
and pristine and, you know, very futuristic, very modern.
Yeah.
And to have that on the background, but then in the foreground is a guy stuffing his face. It was like perception in the back, reality in the front.
Right.
And we need to clean this up is, I think, the goal. And that's why he made the documentary, and I think that's why they chose the cover art design and even the title of it, just to you know, a little check-in, be like, hey guys, you know, we're not, we haven't arrived in this 2000s that we were envisioning all this whole time.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that.
But, nice to meet you. Thank you.
Is there anything else about Super Size Me that you wish, that you think is relevant to the why they made it? Or
I think what's really fascinating about it was it's kind of a hokey, if you really think about the concept of it, it's kind of a hokey idea, right? I'm just going to eat a bunch of French fries and a burger and see what it does for me. But I think the impact that it ended up having.
Yeah.
Is so it talks about the time period that we lived in at the time.
Yeah, and
like we were all willing to listen.
Right.
And I think there's a universal collective understanding at that time that doesn't necessarily exist the same way today. Like
right.
We don't all watch the same thing. There's more diversity today than there was then. And so I just think that the impact that you could have with something like a show about a guy eating a bunch of French fries is speaking or very telling of the time and what we listened to him.
Right.
We trusted him, we listened to him, and it demanded change.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, we listened to a lot of people that were criticizing what was going on. And it could also kind of speak to why we question so much about what's put in front of us now.
Mm-hmm. And 'cause just as there were people like him and Michael Moore making it, you know, coming from that pretty progressive way of looking at things, there was also the detractors to them, but this is all before social media really took off. I mean, the limit, we had like MySpace around then, but
right.
That wasn't
not the same
really anywhere near what it was going to be, and we didn't have streaming services, we didn't have
no,
all that
right.
I'm
you
pretty
had to
sure
rent it.
If you went through Netflix now, you'd probably find at least 10 documentaries similar to that
that are not getting the same attention,
right? Because
just because of the plethora of them,
right?
Yeah.
They just all fall into the same category, and so we were at like this point in the early 2000s, just pre-YouTube, pre-Facebook really taking off, pre-smartphone, where you had a much more limited, by comparison, assortment of people to listen to, and they did wield some power with that because they knew their audience, just like Upton Sinclair 100 years earlier,
right?
Only had so much media access, and so that's where we are.
Yeah.
You know, the podcasting hadn't even taken off yet. That was right around the time podcasting right. showed up, and so
yeah.
If somebody tried to do the same thing now, you would have
completely different response.
Yeah, it would just fall into this giant supersized fry, you know, or cola, you know, it'd be a drop of Coke inside that
right.
giant bucket. So
absolutely.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope
it's
this
been
is
fun.
The last time that we talk.
The Everything is a Primary Source project is a collaborative, open source digital archive of oral history based on reactions and relationships to popular culture. Each entry into the archive begins with a conversation recorded during one of our Your History Through Pop Culture exhibits, also known as podcast karaoke. These are held at a variety of different venues and can be booked for your school, library, museum, or business to be carried out in person or virtually. The next step is to post the primary source in its appropriate category at everything-history.com and supplement it with a short essay contextualizing the book, movie, album, show, toy, game, gadget, or whatever else might be the subject. This will usually be done by us, but these essays could be your way of collaborating. Each recording typically covers just one or two of the 9 critical thinking questions that are asked in order to decide what an artifact tells us about time and place. This leaves room for teachers and their students from all over to contribute by recording their own thoughts on the subject until all of the questions are answered. You can even take part without typing or talking. Each entry will have a space for you to include your pictures of related primary sources that help make the time period and place in question clear. Teachers and their classes are able to use the archives as reliable secondary sources while the entries are under construction, and absolutely when they're completed. And while some topics might be reserved for older students, the Everything is a Primary Source project will always have something for everyone. The Everything is a Primary Source project promotes history, media, and digital literacies, cultural appreciation and collaboration between people of different ages, geography, and backgrounds. Ultimately, it demonstrates how fun it is to learn about history through pop culture. Start your collaborative journey today at everything-history.com.